Does your antiperspirant keep you dry all day? Dove Men Plus Care Dry Spray goes on instantly dry for a cleaner feel and offers 48 hours sweat and odor protection. Let me repeat that. 48 hours of sweat and odor protection. Use it and don't even think about it. Also, Dove Men Dry Spray contains Dove's unique one-quarter moisturizing cream that helps protect your skin. Try Dove Men Plus Care Dry Spray. Goes on dry. Clean feel all day.
This is the Rich Eisen Show.
Daddy's hosting today, kids.
Oh, yeah.
Live from the Rich Eisen Show studio in Los Angeles.
I think it's been pretty obvious the mutual decision on both sides is to move on.
Baker's the one. You're breaking up with me. I'm breaking up with you first.
Earlier on the show, ESPN MLB insider Jeff Passan. Panthers wide receiver DJ Moore. PGA Tour golfer Mark Hubbard. Still to come. Writer and director Ron Shelton. And now, it's Rich Eisen.
Yes, it is. Can confirm. Hour number three of the Rich Eisen Show is on the air here from Los Angeles, California. We've already been on the air for a couple of hours. If you missed our first hour chat with Jeff Passan, who covers baseball for the worldwide leader in sports, talked a little Freddie Freeman and Angels Mariners brawl with him in hour number one. DJ Moore of the Carolina Panthers in hour two. Great chat with Mark Hubbard, who is a grinder on the PGA Tour, who got in last week's Travelers because Brooks Koepka left for the LIV Tour, and he popped on our radar screen, and we said, let's talk to him. And if you missed any of those conversations, youtube.com/Rich Eisen Show, but thrilled to have here in studio in hour number three, one of my favorite people that Susie and I have had the pleasure of getting to know and meet in our time here in Los Angeles, California, the author of this book that I'm holding up in my hands that's available wherever you can get your books on Tuesday, July the 5th. It is a terrific book called The Church of Baseball, The Making of Bull Durham, Home Runs, Bad Calls, Crazy Fights, Big Swings, and a Hit. None other than Ron Shelton. Great to see you, sir.
I'm just happy to be here. Hope I can help the ball club.
Yeah, okay, I appreciate that. You've been called up into a starting status here on this program
for the El Segundo A team.
Yes. Yeah, see? Hey, man. Congrats on the book.
Thank you.
I cannot wait to voraciously take this in. This appeared at our house, Susie and our house, on Tuesday. I'm like, wait a minute, Ron's got a book? What the hell's going on? And boom, here you are on a Wednesday because your schedule was awesome to be free. Why write the book?
First of all, before coming here, I brought a signed copy. I wasn't sure the publisher copy got to you.
Yes.
But I want you to look at it because I just watched in the green room,
yes,
Tim and my godson, Jack Henry,
yes,
and Tim said his favorite line from the movie. Now, I've signed this 2 hours ago for you and Susie.
Okay, this is great. Okay. This is great.
Oh, no way.
This is kind of like newlywed game stuff,
yeah,
right? Like, you wrote it down before. So, again, you're referring to when Tim and Jack Henry Robbins were here on the show last March, and in advance of your appearance here last hour, we showed a clip from that conversation where you asked Chris, right? You asked Tim Robbins his favorite line from the movie, and he said, "The rose goes in the front."
Rose goes in the front.
All right. That's the setup here. So you signed this to Susie and I. Okay. Rich and Susie, my friends, the rose goes in the front. Always remember that, Ron Shelton.
There you go. That's awesome.
It's my marital advice. And one more thing
while
we're on domestic.
Yes.
You have best dad ever.
Yes, sir.
I promised to embarrass my son,
who
just gave me these socks for Father's Day. Can we get those?
Let's see what we got here. It's a super dad. You've got super
look at
dad socks.
That's my son. There you go, Anton.
There you go. Very nice. Socks for Father's Day is such a Father's Day.
The scary thing is he's 18. He just graduated from high school. All league catcher, I imagine, but that was his. Basically, I got those socks, and yeah.
So, are you raising a Crash Davis in your own household, Ron?
Yeah, I am.
Pretty much.
Actually, yeah.
Oh, how about Crash? So let's get into the book here. Like, why did you decide to write a behind the scenes or a making of Bull Durham?
It was an accident that happened because I wrote something about it, and a literary agent got it and said, you want to write a book? I can sell the." And I had no intention to ever write a book. And then the pandemic hit, and I'm home.
Yeah.
So I wrote a book. But the introduction to the book tells a couple stories about why. Over the years, I'm always asked about the movie. There's so much misprinted about it.
Mm-hmm.
Harrison Ford was not offered the part. Cher was not offering. There's so much crap out there.
Yes.
And I went to Durham, excuse me, about 4 years ago for the 30th anniversary of the movie. And I'm like mayor down there because the town was boarded up when we made the movie. And then the economy came back and everybody says, the movie must have done it. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I could be a mayor, seriously. And I get the red carpet treatment every time. And Durham, by the way, is an incredibly nice place to live now. Everything's fixed up and the abandoned warehouses or condos and the new ballpark, the whole thing. So I'm down there, and before the game, I'm doing a Q&A with fans. They got 500 people in a section of the 12,000-seat ballpark. And this couple says, they get the mic and they say, my husband and I moved to Durham because of the movie. Can we take a picture with you and our two sons? Mm-hmm. I said, sure, come on down here. Mm-hmm. So the Durham ball team had a photographer in the local paper. And the boy was 10 and the boy was 8. And I'm posing and I looked down at the boy and I said, what's your name? He said, my name is Crash. And I looked at the mother and I looked at the young one. I said, I'm afraid to ask. What's your name? And he looked at the mother and she says, tell him, son. He says, yep, I'm Nuke.
Get out of here.
So I said, I got to write a book. If this,
they named their kids Crash and Nuke.
If they're naming their kids after these guys, you know, it's time for me to tell my version of the story. So that's honestly what triggered it.
Did they get candlesticks for their wedding?
They will. I've already got them picked up.
Because, you know, I hear that's a good thing to get for somebody's wedding. My gosh, wow. That is so cool. And the great part about this book, too, is it's about the making of the movie. And how the hell did you get this made, Ron? Because you had zero standing in the film community, right? In the screenwriting community, pretty much.
I was lucky. I was very lucky. And, you know, what is opportunity meets whatever that line is. And there's a chapter that reads like a thriller about how close it came to not getting made. I mean, it came down to the minute of losing Costner and everybody turned it down twice with Kevin attached, every studio. Who are you? You've never made a movie. And minor leagues, who cares?
Script was already written. Kevin attached,
yeah.
Right?
And then I got Kevin attached.
How did you get Kevin Costner attached before we continue
I knew his agent, and I sent her the script. And she didn't care if I had a big career yet. Mm-hmm. I had a writing career, not a directing career. And she liked me, and she gave it to Kevin, and Kevin liked it. He was about to do another movie. Mm-hmm. And he was having creative differences with the other movies. So there was this like brief window that if I could land the big fish, and we did in the nick of time. I mean, I had 30 days to get the movie made, or he had to go do Everybody's All-American, the football movie.
Yes.
That Dennis Quaid later started.
Right.
Frank DeFord story. And his big agent wanted him to do the other movie, and his younger agent wanted him to do my movie. And on the last day, we'd been turned down everywhere. At Thursday, we lose him at 6 o'clock Friday, Kevin, for the other movie, because he can't not have a job in the...
Sure.
And we called Orion Pictures in New York. I had written Under Fire for them, which they loved. It was not a hit here, but it was a big hit in Europe. And Kevin had a movie in the can for 6 months there called No Way Out that they were afraid to release because he ends up being a communist spy in it, right?
But an incredible movie.
Spoiler alert, Ron. I mean, come on.
All we remember is the back of the limo with Sean Young. And
Gene Hackman.
Great movie. Awesome. A great movie.
But yes, right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Anyway, so they had sat on it because they didn't know what to do. And it was late August, which was the burial ground for movies in those days.
Yes.
School hasn't started. Everybody's on vacation. And we called them, Kevin and I, and no email in those days. So we called his agency, William Morris in New York, and said, run over 2 hard copies. They're still in their office at 7 o'clock. And I said to them, we got to know tomorrow because Kevin will do the other movie. And at noon the next day, they called and said, it's 3 o'clock in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They said, are you really going to lose him? I said, I'm not lying. We're going to lose him. And by Monday, we had a greenlit movie, and 5 weeks later, we were shooting.
No kidding.
5 weeks later, yeah.
Just under the gun.
I mean, We would have never, and I don't think I'd ever got it made. So,
and then between that, I've got Ron Shelton here on the Rich Eisen Show. His new book, we're just getting just a slice of the stories, a small little sliver of stories in the making of Bull Durham, the Church of Baseball, the making of Bull Durham, new book that you can start getting on July 5th where all books are acquired. So what about the rest of the cast? I know you told this story before on this show, but we might as well tell it again here, how Susan Sarandon was not a shoo-in either. The movie.
In the book, I talk about something called The List with a capital L.
Right.
Every studio, network, streaming company has a list of actors and actresses that are acceptable for financing purposes at any given moment. But the list keeps changing. Mm-hmm. Names come off it and on it. So you're trying to cast the movie from people that are on the list in the lead parts. The secondary parts don't matter. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't on the list. And we didn't know why. And so other women were on the list and then off the list. It was a nightmare. And her agent kept calling. And I kept saying, she's not right for the part. Well, I knew she was right for the part, but I can't tell the truth that she's not on the list because that's giving away company secrets. And then the studio head starts screaming at me.
Right.
And I haven't even started my career yet. So so finally, the agent says, she's living in Italy with her two-year-old. And she's going to fly on her own dime from Italy to L.A. Will you see her? And I said, yes, I'll see her if she flies. I mean, I can't not see her.
Right.
So I said, Kevin, be here in the office out of respect. And Susan comes pretty much from the airport in this killer tube dress, man. Remember tube dresses?
Yes, I do.
It has horizontal red and white stripes. And, you know, Susan can stop traffic.
Yes.
And she comes in boldly, and she doesn't look like she got off a 14-hour flight,
right.
I guarantee you. I think her kid and the nanny were in the car together out in the parking lot.
Sure. Right?
And she comes in. She just owns the room. She just pushes Kevin around and charms him and, you know, charms everybody, and she leaves. And so we're all sitting around. It's late in the day on a Friday, I think. Mm-hmm. And we said, well, she was great, but she's not on the list. What are we going to do? What we do is what I always do. I pour a drink, you know, to slow the mind. And about an hour later, I get a call from Mike Medavoy, who ran the studio.
Yes.
And he said, you know, I was looking at the list here. He didn't know we just met her. And Susan Sarandon, I saw her a couple of weeks ago at an event, and mm-hmm. she's looking great, so let's put her on the list. And we knew that he didn't see her 2 weeks ago. She was in Italy 2 weeks ago. What she did was she went straight from the meeting to Orion Pictures, started working her way up and down the hallway till she found Medavoy's office and dazzled all the men in the hallway, left for the airport to fly back to Italy, and he put her on the list because of that red and white tube dress, I guarantee you.
And that's how Annie was born into your film.
And she gets to Italy and gets a call that she's been hired because I hired her immediately.
And so
she has to fly from Italy to Durham.
So did she love the script too? Is that what happened?
Yeah.
I mean, you had her at hello with the script and everything else.
She knew the script. I mean, she didn't carry it around. She auditioned like ready to shoot.
And how did Tim Robbins get attached to this? Because again, your godson is Jack Henry. And that was the funny thing when he was here on studio is like, this is the movie that created me because this
funny.
Is where
that was funny.
His parents met. So how did Tim
that
Robbins
was the hardest part to cast because some of the athletic guys were like young versions of Kevin, and you couldn't have a 20-year-old version of Kevin when you had the 36-year-old version of Kevin.
Right.
Why would she go with a younger version? So you had to have somebody very different, and he came in. He was 6'4" or 6'5". He's a big, big guy, and he was youthful and ebullient, and you know he was 30 playing 19. He had such a boyish face, and mm-hmm. he was just so different than Kevin. That I put them in a room together, and I thought that's great chemistry because they're so different that, you know, chemistry in movies, the book talks about this, has to
yes.
be two people are completely different. You know, you can't put, I mean, that's why Bogart would work with Paul Honreid. He wouldn't work with another tough guy. Nicholson doesn't work with another tough guy. He works with mm-hmm. somebody different. So anyway, I was very lucky to find him, and he also, I thought he had never made a movie. He had made one, and they didn't tell me about it, called Howard the Duck, which was the biggest bomb in history.
I know, right.
He was the lead in it, but he didn't tell me, and the agents didn't tell me. So
for good reason, though, right?
Yeah, after I hired him, somebody said, you hired the lead in Howard the Duck? And I said, you're kidding me. But he was great.
Of course he was. Ron Shelton here on the Rich Eisen Show. Before we take a break, I just want to ask this question. You must have some terrific insight on it. I have some idea of it, but I'd love to hear from you. Costner is in Bull Durham. Costner is in Tin Cup, which we're going to talk about a little bit in the next segment as well. Costner in Field of Dreams. Costner made his own sports movie as well in For Love of the Game. And he was terrific in Draft Day, when I thought we would never see him in another sports movie again. And it was just one of those moments at the end of that movie where he just dominated the scene. And it was, you made you love sports and love the moment. Why do you think he's so perfect for those moments in these movies, Ron Shelton?
I think he's a great fit for me because we both came out of working families. You know, we didn't grow up with a, I mean, he was from Ventura, I'm from Santa Barbara, but we didn't have a silver spoon in our mouth, and we had working parents, and, you know, and we were high school athletes and junior high athletes, and in my case, a college and beyond athlete. So we both came out of not totally dissimilar backgrounds and kind of had to claw our way into the business. You know, I mean, I used to knock on doors and leave scripts and stuff, pass them out like a homeless guy in the street. Read my script. Here's my number. And so I think he's a hard worker, and I'm a hard worker, and we both really respect how difficult sports is at a high level or at any level. And a lot of people who are just fans don't get, this is a tough way to make a living, you know. And I think movie making is very athletic. It's preparation, 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 and then action. You know, the whistle blows, the ball is kicked off, the ball is tipped, the first pitch of the game, and suddenly all that preparation becomes instinctive and intuitive, not rational anymore. And so making a movie is very similar to playing a game.
What about a relatability factor, though, too, right? I mean, like, you've got to – it's not just believing him as an athlete. There's just – I'm just trying to find, like, what – because he's great in everything he does. Yeah. I mean, even now, right here on Peacock, you could see all of Yellowstone, and everything that the guy does is spectacular. I'm a huge fan. He knows that, too. But I just wonder what – because we talk about it all the time, like sports movies, who's the greatest actor in sports movies? Well, who's been in the ones that resonate the most, the longest? And it's him.
It's him, by far. It's not even close.
Correct?
Yeah, not even close. He, you know, I played pickup basketball with him. He's a good basketball player. You know, how hard is it to look decent hitting a golf ball? It's the most difficult of all of them, you know? He could be in a basketball movie. I mean, he could have then. He could probably ice skate and be in a hockey movie. He's just a natural athlete. And you can't teach that. You can't teach athleticism.
Right. The Church of Baseball, the making of Bull Durham, home runs, bad calls, crazy fights, big swings, and a hit. Let's take a break. I want to hit on, go down a little bit of memory lane and also spin forward, if you're up for it, some of the characters in some of your other iconic films that you put out there. Ron Shelton, now an author to go along with his screenwriting and directing credits. Back here on The Rich Eisen Show in a moment. Ron Shelton back here on the Rich Eisen Show. So, okay.
Running back.
Okay.
He could have gone into any college, except he wasn't interested in books, and he signed right away, and like 3 years later was with Henry Aaron in the majors. So
okay.
Now it's 1957. We don't have a television yet. And we're at Sunday school. My dad gathers us up. We're going to skip church. We're like terrified. And God is going to strike. And he throws us all into the giant station, beat-up station wagon, right? My mom's like, okay with it. Something's up. We get home, and there's a guy from the local department store installing a TV. Because it was the fourth game of the World Series. The Yankees, the Braves against the Yankees. And the Braves were down 2-1, and they were trailing. And we watched the game. And we kept waiting. God is going to come and get us, man. We're skipping. And in the 10th inning, Eddie Matthews hit a 3-run home run to win the game. To win the game.
Yes.
And we started going to church less.
Because and that's why this is called the Church of Baseball?
Eddie Matthews released us from the Old Testament.
That is amazing. When did you decide you wanted to play baseball professionally, Ron? When did that happen?
When I was 3, probably. But in high school, I was the little scrappy guy. I wasn't very big, mm-hmm. but I would like choke up that much and just hit singles everywhere.
Right.
And then in 1 year, I grew to 6'1", 180. And so when I was a freshman in college, suddenly, like, no D1 school would have been interested in me in high school.
Mm-hmm.
But suddenly, in freshman in college, everybody was, scouts were saying, wait a minute,
mm-hmm.
where'd this guy come from? Because I had skills, I just didn't have size. And then I realized I'd have a shot, and I was going to get drafted as a sophomore, but I wanted to keep playing basketball and baseball. So I signed after my senior year.
With who?
With the Orioles.
The Orioles? Okay, so you were always in the Orioles system, pretty much?
No, I thought I was going to sign with the Angels. And then my whole career, I was in the Orioles system.
Right. Who was with you in the Orioles system that we know?
There's a funny story in here. I signed. I went from LAX, I went from Santa Barbara to Bluefield, West Virginia, in the middle of coal country.
Uh-huh.
The rookie league, the Appalachian League. And I get there. I'm a third baseman. And there's 50, 60 guys there. The season starts the next day. And I'm going, but there's only 25 roster spots. So 60 guys thought they were on a team and we're still competing.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at it and there's less guys taking infield at short than anywhere else. So I said, I'm a shortstop. This is true. And I made the team. It's a really great story. And started the next night.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 weeks later, Joe Altobelli is starting his career as a manager after a career, Crash Davis kind of career.
Yes.
Cup of coffee in the big leagues, triple A star. He calls me in and he says, son, big cigarette, he says, how'd you like to play second base? And I said, no, I'm playing shortstop. I'm killing it. I'm hitting third. I haven't made an error. And he says, well, Orioles just signed their number one pick, a kid out of Long Beach named Bobby Gritch.
Bobby Gritch.
I said, he's got to beat me out. And he says, son, he's already beat you out. He's their number one pick. They give him a lot of money. How much money they give you? I said, well, what about our second baseman, Jimmy Morrell? Mm-hmm. He's doing great.
Mm-hmm.
Joe's on the camera. He says, son, do you want to play second base or do you want Jimmy Morrell to play second base? And I said, Skip, I love second base. And Jimmy Morrell is gone the next day. And welcome to pro baseball.
I thought for some reason you were saying third base, you had to move off it because Brooks Robinson was going to be living there anyway for forever and a day. So I thought that's where that was going.
When I got to AAA,
yeah.
We had a AAA third baseman who had been 4 years in a row International League All-Star.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get a cup of coffee in the big leagues till he was 32 years old. It was Mike Ferraro. He was a hell of a player.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was insurance for Brooks. And rather than sit on the bench in Baltimore, they wanted him to be sharp, and so he played every day and not getting a chance in the big leagues.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's what a story that is.
Until he was over the hill. Yeah.
What a story that is. Yeah. That's unreal. He
was a bit of the inspiration, not his personality, but his dilemma for Crash Davis.
I'd imagine so, right? That you're there and you want to be in the bigs, but they need you to stay sharp. So you go where you can get the ABs, and Brooks Robinson's never going to – I mean, he hardly missed anything.
He never missed a game.
Unbelievable.
And then the other guy who was inspiration was, I write a lot about this guy, Steve Dalkowski,
mm-hmm.
who's considered the hardest thrower ever played by almost everybody. And in the minor leagues, in Bakersfield, he would show up begging money. He was an alcoholic. And then he would come to the clubhouse and Joe Altobelli, who was my manager most of my career, he would go out and give him money. And we'd say, who is that, Joe? He said, that's Steve Dalkowski. And these stories of Dalkowski started coming out. He'd been in the Baltimore organization for, I think, 10 years.
Right.
His career was 13 strikeouts, 13 walks a game. He had one game with 20 strikeouts, 20 walks.
And, come on.
Oh, yeah. No, he's like threw 300, 400 pitches a game. He was a little lefty, and I mean, the legends are all, I write about him in the thing, and he took him all these years to, and Earl Weaver, a minor league manager in Double A, got him to, like Sandy Koufax, don't throw so hard, Steve. Just don't throw 100 miles an hour. Just throw 80%. And so he had this great year in Triple A, and he made the major league roster after 12 years, and he hurt his arm in spring training, fielding a bunt. So he gets to AAA, and he was an alcoholic, too, Dalko.
Mm-hmm.
Died COVID, sadly, in a rest home. So Dalko was gets to AAA after all these years in the minors.
Yeah.
And they room him with Joe Altobelli, who's a 36-year-old AAA veteran, because he's so one guy's so mature and the other guy's a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, Joe, your job is to mature him and just keep an eye on him. And I said, what was that like? And Joe says, the old line, he says, I don't know, I roomed with his suitcase because he was out drinking all night.
And that's...
That became that relationship of Nuke and of Dalkowski and Joe Altobelli, not the specifics of their character,
sure,
but the dynamic became...
Nuke and Crash.
Became Bulldog.
Ron Shelton here on the Rich Eisen Show. All right, let's have a little bit of fun here if you're up for it, even though I haven't told you about it, so hopefully you are up for it. We have two characters from four of your films, including Bull Durham, where now everything there's sequel mania once again, certainly with Top Gun Maverick making $1 billion worldwide. I'm wondering if I'll give you two characters. You tell me where you think they are today. Off the top of your head, Ron Shelton.
Yep.
Okay, we're going to start with from the film Bull Durham, as we've just discussed. Where is Crash Davis today, would you think?
Crash Davis went to the minor, started in Visalia as a manager, and he's worked his way up, and it's taken him all these years. And Durham is now a AAA town, so he's worked his way up to Durham, which used to be a gateway to oblivion, and now it's possibly the gateway to the big leagues.
Mm-hmm.
So he's on the verge of actually getting to the big leagues as a manager.
And that's how we find Crash Davis right
yes,
now.
Yes, there's other things.
Okay.
Annie.
Where's it? Is Annie still with her right now?
Well, it didn't work out. I outlined in the afterword of the book the outline for the sequel I once had that didn't happen.
Okay.
Everybody's too old now, but yeah, after they carry it, it didn't work because she's not going to travel around being the supportive wife of Snitker's wife or whatever. And I love Brian Snitker.
But, by the way, that's a great, like, that sounds like a rejected Neil Simon movie, right? The Snitker's wife. Snitker's wife. All right.
Well, she's an angel. All those wives are angels.
Sure, right. Yeah.
I mean, Andy Reid's wife. Jesus, what they.
Right.
So, and I love Snitker and I love Andy Reid, so I can use their wives.
Sure,
it doesn't work because she can't do that. So she ends up teaching in the Sorbonne in Paris as an expert on Edith Piaf.
The singer.
Great singer who she's always playing in her house.
That's right.
Well, and she's like the legendary French singer. But who is... Susan, really an expert on about Piaf's life. Who was Piaf's love, big love? Marcel Cerdan, the middleweight boxing champion.
Mm-hmm.
There's movies been made about this, that her love was an athlete, Piaf's. So she falls in love, she thinks, with a French director, but she doesn't realize that it's not real love until she goes back to teach 1 year at Duke University. And runs into
manager,
the manager, Crash. So where has Nuke been?
Yes, that's the next one. Yes.
Nuke's been in Venezuela working on a knuckleball. And he hasn't even noticed that the country's gone to hell. And who discovers him down there? Well, Robert Wool never gets to the big leagues as pitching coach, Larry Hockett. He ends up being a scout, which is the worst job in the world. And he ends up in Latin America, where at least you find great players, in Venezuela, but there's no economy, so he's living in his car. And he discovers Nuke with a pretty good Jim Boughton, knuckleball, and they're reunited, and he calls the big club and says, look, there's always room for a knuckleball. This guy, first-round draft pick. So where does he go? Goes to Durham. And they're all reunited.
Oh, wow.
That's a movie that'll never get made.
Oh, sequel, man. I'm all in. Let's get the time machine. Man. Ron Shelton here on the Rich Eisen Show. Let's play a little Where Are They Now from Blue Chips.
Okay.
Coach Pete Bell. What happened to him? Where's Coach Pete Bell right now, do you think?
He's in Turkey. He's in the Turkish Basketball League.
Okay.
Which is actually a pretty good league.
Yeah.
He's coaching the women's team.
Fantastic.
There's some really interesting stories. There was a woman that played for the L.A. Sparks who I tried to get the rights, and it was too complicated. Although now, in the demands of the business, the mandates, maybe she was, you know, big, strong, power forward, mm-hmm. You know, lesbian. It's common in that league. And she was also Muslim and trash talker, and she was really funny. I'm not going to mention her name.
Okay.
She ends up in a getting in trouble here in the WNBA and for a charge that was later dropped. It was a false charge. And she ends up in the Turkish League. This is true. Where she's MVP. And she's this phenomenon in Turkey because she's talking trash on and off the court, and they love her. And the NBA, WNBA forgives her. They realize the charge was false. And she has a chance to come back. And the team she picked was whatever the Washington, D.C. women's team is called, because she had a crush on Condoleezza Rice. This is a true story. She said, I want me some Condi. The woman told me this. I said, this is a movie, man. I can do this. But I couldn't get anybody interested.
So you would weave Coach Pete Bell into this?
He would be coaching her.
Okay. And then the other character from Blue Chips were wondering about, where's Happy Kuykendall today? Where's the booster today, do you think?
Name a university.
Well, let's see. We have an idea. Western University. He runs the Western University NIL program, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Name, image, and likeness?
Yep.
It's because now his world, Happy's world, is... Yeah, he's codified.
He's the new Sonny Vaccaro, you know.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
He's
made it. He's like the guy who's the guy I wrote a script about him that'll never get made. The Balco Lab
Victor Conti.
Victor Conti. I parked outside Victor Conti's house and waiting for him to come out and pin him down. He was the guy selling all the drugs to everybody.
Yeah, right.
And it was busted. Big by the paper, and the great book called Game of Shadows came out.
Of course, I remember that. Yeah.
Great book. We optioned that too. And Conti, who's the biggest drug dealer ever, is now leading the anti-drug charge, working with the WADA and all that. It's like,
he's seen the light.
You were
cream in the clear.
You're Pablo Escobar, and now you're the DEA. How did this happen?
So Happy's working for Victor Conti?
Yeah. That's right.
All right, next up, where are they now? Ron Shelton. This is just off the top of your head. Ron has no idea this is coming. Where is Billy Hoyle today, do you think? Ron Shelton. It's like we're workshopping. We're in the writer's room right
Billy's,
now.
No, Billy's sad. I think Billy never escapes. You know, he's working... You know, the best he can do is work for Caltrans with an orange vest leaning on a broom by the side of the road. That would be good for Billy.
That's where Billy Hoyle is today.
That would be the best. But probably he's working in a rec center somewhere, you know, sweeping the floor and trying to play horse games with young kids. I don't think, at least in my, I think he was doomed.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. Does that bum you out, Chris?
Kind of. I mean... You could kind of see that by the end of the movie that Billy is just kind of trapped in a world that by his own doing he can't get out of. And it does make sense, even though you want what's best for him because he's a very likable guy.
I'm going to go off the road here. How'd you get Marcus Johnson for that movie? How'd you get him?
Marcus auditioned, and I loved him from when he was a great high school player at Crenshaw High to UCLA.
He auditioned. He read for the role?
Yeah.
Marcus Johnson?
Yeah. And
did you know he was coming in, like Marcus Johnson was coming in to read for the role?
Well, I saw who was coming in, and I said, this is Marcus Johnson.
Was he the only NBA player that came in to read for that role? Do you remember?
Yeah.
Recall? Okay.
Yeah. But he was, Marcus, a great guy, by the way. Really,
yeah.
Really great guy. And people forget what a dominant player he was till he hurt his neck. He got hit in a car accident. Yeah. But he was like all pro his first 6 or 7 years, and the Wooden Award winner. I mean.
He was very believable in this role. Well, and he was going to go get his gun. That's for sure.
Don't go to the glove box.
And then the next one, where is Gloria Clemente today? Where do you think Gloria is today?
Oh, she's gigantic. She's gigantic because she is made for this world of social media. And, you know, I mean, she would be all these women and men who have giant careers and you don't know what they do. Well, she actually does stuff. So she would be dwarfing the Kardashians
right now. She'd be the all-time Jeopardy champ right now.
Ken Jennings.
Would she be Ken Jennings? Would she be like?
I doubt that.
Okay.
She'd
be guest hosting Jeopardy.
She would have leveraged her appearance.
No doubt about that. Last one for you. Where is Roy McAvoy today from Tin Cup? Where do you think Roy is today?
He's on the live tour.
Hold on a second. Roy would never join the live tour. You think he would join the live tour?
I hope not, because I loathe the live tour.
Because that was our choice for where David Sims is today. We'll give you one here.
Sims is, yeah, you're right. Sims is on the live tour, and he's probably on the board with Patrick Reed and all those guys.
Greg Norman.
We think that he would be the guy who stalks the players on the PGA Tour to call them up on behalf of Greg Norman to say, you should come. Like, that's what David Sims is doing today.
McElroy
right?
has too much soul. He just, he's playing on some satellite tour somewhere, senior satellite tour. But yeah, the live tour, don't get me started. I mean, you made your choice, fine. Let me pose this. You didn't ask the question, but.
Go for it.
People who say, well, the U.S. government does business with... governments have a job of self-preservation of nations. This is different. What if I said, if you defend the live tour, blood money and all, I said, okay, what if Kim Jong-un starts a tour in North Korea, backed by Chinese money, and he doubles the live tour money? Do you have any qualms about taking that money? And what's the difference?
You would ask this of the players on the live tour,
what's
right
the
now.
Difference? Now, where do you draw a line?
They're saying they're growing the game, Ron.
Well, they're not growing the game. They're growing their bank account. I mean, it's also not competitive. It's exhibition golf. Think about it. All these guys are supposed to be political conservatives who say, I got no beef with you. There's no free lunch. You got to earn it. That's what competition's about. The winner gets the sport. Wait a minute. Here's $100 million. It doesn't matter if you win or lose. It's exhibition golf, and you play three rounds. Think about that.
Yeah.
It defies everything that sports is about. Now, Matt Wolf says, look, I can't deal with the, he's just having meltdowns. I just need it. If it's exhibition golf, I'll take it. At least he was honest about it. But you're not growing golf.
That's why David Sims is doing it.
Oh, yeah, you're right. He's on the board.
We were thinking, but Roy, does Roy ever make it back to a major? What do you think?
Well, he did in the sequel that we tried to get Warners to make, and then Warners was changing heads of studio, and the sequel is going to be called Cup at the Q, and he goes to Q school.
Oh man!
And we couldn't sell that on, so then I wrote with John Norville, who wrote Tin Cup with me.
Yeah,
played at Stanford, really good player and writer. We wrote a movie called Q School. Just forget it. And then Costner was going to do it, but we couldn't make deals with everybody. We had a deal 2 years ago, and it all fell apart.
So Cup at the Q School. So Costner would have had to go back to try and get his tour card again? That Roy McAvoy was trying to get his tour card again?
Yeah, by finishing in the top 10 at the Open, you get invited next year to a couple of things. But you don't get your tour card.
Right.
So, yes, the character would have had to go back and qualify. And I went to the Q School a couple of times and hung out down at Palm Springs.
To see what's up, just to see what's
up. Yeah, and Lee Jansen was there. He has two U.S. Opens. He was trying to get his card again.
Wow.
Think about that.
It's crazy.
Man, I would be into a Roy McAvoy prequel, because there are all the legendary stories about how great he was, and like him and a young Cheech Marin.
And then what happened?
And then
what do you think about that?
Meltdown.
Can Kevin play 30?
Yeah, there's plenty of young guys now.
Well, I know. Then you have to recast it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Get Josh Lucas to do it, right? I mean, isn't that the little Yellowstone connection right there?
Josh Lucas is a good golfer. I got a call from an agency yesterday and from the producing partner on Tin Cup saying there's two names. I'm going to use them. No, I won't use them.
Okay.
But I'm going to meet with them. They mean a lot, and they're golf nuts as actors. They want to develop it as a series. And I said, I'll sit down and hear your idea. Because Warner Brothers owns the rights. I don't have they have to buy in. But there's still area to be mined.
Yeah,
I think so too.
Question about it, Ron. Yeah. I have no doubt about it. And you know who would be producing partners?
Of course.
The people who he's inscribed the book to. Come on now.
Get the rose in the front.
The rose in the front, everybody. The Church of Baseball, the making of Bull Durham. Home runs, bad calls, crazy fights, big swings, and a hit. Must read material from Ron Shelton. You are the man. Anytime, Ron. Anytime. You know that. You're the best.
When I come back, I forgot to do this.
Yes.
I got a bobblehead.
Okay.
For you.
Okay.
Of me.
Okay.
One face is a director, one's a baseball player. Because a couple years ago, I got into the Rochester Red Wing Hall of Fame.
Okay.
And I went back there with my wife and son, who didn't know that part of me way back then.
Sure.
And I didn't know it, but they gave me a bobblehead, and it was very moving to get a bobblehead.
So, yeah.
Do you have one?
I do, actually. It's up on the wall over there, and that's part of the reason why, you know. You got one more segment left in you? Let's take a break. We got Ron Shelton here for one more segment. That's why we'll wrap up the show on the Rich Eisen Show in a second. Back here in our terrestrial radio outfit. You told a story about you had a bobblehead doll that you had made and whatever.
Well, I didn't.
It was made on your behalf. Okay.
Rochester, New York, the Rochester Red Wings, where I played my last year and a half. And had great fondness for it. We had a great team and won all these championships, and I was called back there, even though I probably made more hits after Rochester than at Rochester, but it was great. And I went there with my son and my wife, Lolita, and because they'd never seen me that part of my life.
Yeah.
Because that was a long time ago.
Sure, and that's pretty neat.
And my son threw out the first pitch, and I signed about 1,800 bobbleheads. It's hard to sign a bobblehead.
I can imagine so. I mean, you asked me if I had one made, and so here's the story. I was towards the end of my ESPN tenure, and I was beginning to feel like maybe ESPN wasn't really the place for me long term, which was really freaking me out because it was such a part of my identity. And it was like I won the lottery as a 26-year-old to come from Redding, California's ABC affiliate to be on SportsCenter at the heyday. And the thing that really made me feel that way is that ESPN management made bobbleheads of SportsCenter anchors, and I wasn't one of them.
What?
And so, right. So I thought to myself, you know,
writing's on the wall.
Well, writing's on the wall. How petty is it of me to go into management to complain? Why didn't you make a bobblehead of me? Like, there's no win there, except I just internalized it. It's just, you know, having that writing on the wall. So when I was hired at NFL Network, and I reached out to during the difficulty of my negotiations to him as just to ask him for advice was Steve Bornstein, who was the former president of ESPN and then had moved to NFL Network, and he wound up hiring me a second time, which shows just how smart of an executive he really is. I told him at the time, I'm like, I'm not feeling it at ESPN right now. And he said, why? And I told him that story, and I had no idea. I think I thought like he's going to look at me like I'm crazy. I had no idea that he had remembered it. And when I got hired at NFL Network, he made these bobbleheads of me holding up a number one jersey because I was his first round draft choice of NFL Network. There's only like six of these. And he gave me a note saying, you know, you're bobblehead worthy to me, which is I get emotional just even seeing this crazy thing.
I get it. And that's really smart management by Bornstein too.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think somewhere in the book it says, give a movie star $1 million or give him $100,000 in his own parking space. He'll take the parking space for $100,000.
I hear you. And this thing is also, too, it just reminds me of the time I had had hair. You know, if you bobble the hair, it doesn't come out, Ron. You know, it's one of those things. At any rate, just, you know, wanted to tell that story since you asked. Thanks for coming on, man. Greatly appreciate it. Congrats on this book. Are you going to go on a tour of any sort like that or what?
I do a bunch of stuff starting Tuesday in L.A., and then I go to New York on the 25th of July for a week of stuff, and then I go to Durham for 3 days.
So you're going to sign books and things like that?
Yeah, and they do a film forum screening, and I do book signings all over the place, and then a lot of interviews, and then Durham, which I requested for 3 days, which is my favorite part of it.
I love that. That is so great. They just love everything about this movie there. And I know anytime we talk about it, I see the Durham Bulls retweet it, and they just go crazy for it. Is there like a website that people can find out when you're coming into town or anything like that?
I don't know. I have no social media, including websites. Nothing.
You got nothing?
Zero. Zero.
You're old school when it comes to
old
that.
Old school. I don't have time for
that. I love that. Thank you for coming on this show, Ron. Congratulations. The Church of Baseball, again, where all books are acquired, starting July 5th, day after our nation's birthday, the making of Bull Durham, home runs, bad calls, crazy fights, big swings, and a hit. I want to thank you, Ron Shelton. Also, today's guests, DJ Moore, Mark Hubbard, a longtime grinder on the PGA Tour, and Jeff Passan of ESPN. Robert Griffin III is on tomorrow's program, and so much more. We'll see you on Thursday.
For the real story behind some of wrestling's biggest moments, it's Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard and Conrad Thompson, too.
All-time Hogan opponents. Macho Man's got to be in the conversation. Where's Andre for you?
I've always said Andre was number one.
Wow.
Because even going back before, you know, Hulk Hogan was a babyface, Hulk and Andre were able to go in and headline at the New Orleans Superdome, at Shea Stadium in Japan. Wherever they went, that was an attraction.
Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.